everybody. My name is Judith Roberts. I'm an alcoholic. I'm so happy to be here. I shared a little bit this afternoon. I shared that it's just wonderful to be somewhere warm and not frozen. Back home, it's 24 below zero right now. That's Fahrenheit. And for you Canadians. But cold is cold. I mean, it's bad. Anyway, so I'm very happy, but not just happy because it's a beautiful environment. But I am so happy because of the warmth in here. You guys are on fire. This is wonderful. And this is my first time, and I can't wait to bring everybody down with it's like, let's go to Mexico. Okay. My sobriety date is January the 19th, 2009. So on Monday, I celebrated 17 years. Thank you for that. I think it's important to mention that I have a sponsor who knows that he's my sponsor, painfully aware that he's my sponsor. I use my sponsor. And I am so grateful. I'm so grateful that I had somebody that took me by the hand, said, come do what I do, took me through this book, and not just take me through the book and the steps, but continues to guide and lead me in the spiritual way of life on a daily basis through his amazing example. He just celebrated, January's the best month for birthdays. He just celebrated 20 years, and his father on the 26th, would have celebrated 61 years, but his father, my sponsor, just walked his father home this week. So he went through the death. He missed his 61st birthday. And it's amazing. I don't know why this is coming out, but his name's Clarence, and I just wanted to take a moment. I didn't know I was going to do this, but back in 1965 in January, he was a submarine, whatever, okay. Thank you. He was on a submarine, but he was in the Navy, and he was one of us, and he was crazy as we appear to be. So his captain or whatever, whoever's in charge of the submarine, sent him. They took him to the psych ward, and they were in America at that point. Took him to the psych ward, and thank God for the doctors, who admit they don't have an answer for us, but they know where to send us. And this doctor, back in 1965, gave him a book of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, there's nothing I can do for you, and sent him back to a ship. So the guy was, Clarence, was reading this book, and in this book it has the address of GSO. And he wrote to GSO and he said, I don't know what to do, I have this book, and I am on a submarine. And he wrote to GSO. And the women at GSO, at the office in New York, started writing to him. And they wrote and wrote. And so, you know, that was during the Cold War, in those diesel submarines, and they'd go around and go around, you know. They would tag behind the Russians, and the Russians would tag behind us, and, you know, it was all sneaky and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, they'd pop up somewhere in the world. And the people on the submarine would get their mail. And Clarence would get bags. And he would take those letters, and it was the letters from the secretaries, Bill's secretary and all the secretaries at GSO. And he had the big book, and he had those letters, and that was his meetings. Every day he would read a letter, and he still has some of those letters. It's so amazing. I was visiting and to read those letters. So I know this isn't my story, but I'm still telling it. Because it's so beautiful, and he just passed, you know, and he's hanging out with Bill now, you know? How cool is that? They're doing the sobriety countdown. He's day one up there. But, so anyway, then comes, so they're sneaking around the world, you know, following the Russians and whatnot, and so then there's Fleet Week in New York, and they pop up in New York, I don't know how many years he had had, but, you know, sailors going off in New York doing what sailors do. But he's like, no. And he headed straight. He to this day, last time I saw him and he's telling this story, tears start coming down his eyes. He said, I headed straight to the office. I wanted to meet my home group. So he went there, and Bill wasn't in. Bill was still alive at that point in time, and he was out for lunch. But he got to sit at Bill's desk in his office, and the women were in there, and they had their first in-person meeting. And then I start griping about the people in my home group. You know? This guy, armed with a book and these women who would type out these letters to him, and that was his meetings, and he's in a submarine alone, popping up here and there all over the world. Wow. Yeah, so he just passed this week. Anyway, back to me. I just want to share that with you. That's my sponsor, and my sponsor's dead. I have a home group. I think it's important that I am not homeless in NAA. And on Thursday nights, you'll be able to find me and where I'm at. And that's called The Three Legacies at 7 o'clock in Bismarck, North Dakota. And if you're ever going through Bismarck, I have no idea why you would be. But if you ever are, stop on by and we go through the steps and the traditions and concepts. And we have a lot of fun. So, I think I say that I can explain or describe myself in two words. And the first word would be baffled. I've been baffled my whole life. I don't know why I've been baffled my whole life. Well, my father's Australian, my mom's American, so that makes me half and half. And I was raised in Australia, and sometimes I don't know what country I'm in, and it's just like, I don't know if that's the cause, but I'm just baffled by a lot of things. I always felt like everybody sort of had it figured out, and I didn't have it figured out. And one of the biggest things that I was baffled about was this elusive thing called happiness. And my whole entire life was this desperate search. I just want to be happy. Is that too much to ask for? I mean, seriously. And I look at all of you, and you all look, I mean, not you, right, but, you know, in the world, and everybody seems to be happy, and I see all this stuff, and I just want to be happy, and I'm out there grasping for happiness, like, have you ever tried to grasp water? It doesn't work. It just you know, runs through your fingers. You can't grasp it, and that's me. It wasn't until I came in here with you guys, and my sponsor says, how about you cup your hands in service and dip it down and see what happens? It fills up. But I'm jumping ahead. So I'm going through life, and I think, you know, the motto I lived by was, I'll be happy when. And you can fill anything in the end of that sentence. I'll be happy when I graduate from college. I'll be happy when I get that degree. I'll be happy when I get that job. And I'll be happy when I get that promotion. I'll be happy when I get him. And then I'll be happy when I get rid of him and get him. And I'll be happy when. And the thing of it is, I've been very blessed in life because I have gotten a lot of my wins. I am the type of alcoholic that's willing to go to any lengths to get what I want. And I see something, and I lock in like a radar. That's it. That's it right there. I need that. And I will go for it, and heaven help you if you're between me and that, because I will just steamroll over you to get to there. And like I said, I would get so, you know, I got a lot of my wins. And I would get it, and the funniest thing would happen. I would be happy for a day, a week, maybe a year. But the strangest thing would happen, and that's the shine would wear off. you know, all my relationships, the jobs, the possessions, and all of that. And the shine would wear off. And then I wouldn't be happy. And then I'd be like, well, I made a mistake. That wasn't it. Obviously, that wasn't it. So I'd be looking around again. Oh, that's it. That. Okay, now I got it. That's it, and I'm going there. And the whole thing is that because it's always out there, I'm never present in my life. I'm never aware of my life. And I'm always out there in the future, reaching, grasping. And I'm just baffled as far as why I can't be happy. And I just don't know what's wrong with me. Because nothing is happening, nothing is making me happy. My favorite things are power and prestige and possessions. And I went for all of it. And I can tell you that none of it worked for me. It's so funny, you know, I hear a lot of speakers and it's like, I came into AA and I had nothing. And then I got sober and I got the wife, the house, the car, the kids, the dog, and the career and all of that. And I had everything when I came in here. And as you'll hear, I lost everything in sobriety. So if you want what I have, go. Like, oh. But anyway, so I was baffled. The other thing, has anyone ever told you that you have a lot of potential? Yeah. Okay, that's not my story. The other thing about me is I have no potential. And I'm not making that up. I have proof. I'm serious. I'm not making this up. A few years ago, my mom, my father passed in 2020. My mom was downsizing. And so, you know, some moms, they collect all the things that you did when you were growing up and your little crafts and your pictures, school pictures, your report cards and all that. Well, my mom collected some of all that. And so then as she's downsizing, she had boxes. I'm one of five siblings. There's five of us. And she put all our stuff in boxes and then gave us each our box. And we happened to be all together for a wedding or whatever. And so I'm going through my box. I'm looking through my box and oh, this is cool, that's cool, whatever. And I came across my report cards in Australia. And I have specifically my eighth grade report card. This is the one I remember. And I pulled it out. And in Australia, they had your grades on this side. And they were really bad, but that's not the point. But on this side, it had a bunch of questions that you're supposed to take it home, have your parents answer the questions, and you take it back, and then at the end of the year, you got all your report card for the year. Every quarter, it got sent home. And these questions were on here. And one of the questions was, what potential does your child show? And I kid you not, my mom wrote, Judith has yet to show any potential. But we pray every day. Yeah. So that's me in a nutshell. I'm baffled and I have no potential. Not a really great scenario for when I come up against something that is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And the first time that happened, alcohol. First time that happened, I'm a really, really late bloomer. I really am. As I said, I was raised in Australia. My father has a doctorate of theology. He was the president of a religious college, university. And so I was raised very, very, very strict. And alcohol was nowhere. In my vicinity, I hadn't been around anyone that drank. And then at 13, I was sent away to boarding school, and I was in boarding school from 13 until I finished my schooling. It was Christian, very, very, very strict, and no opportunities at all. I was never around alcohol. My father died in 2020, and he was 89 years old. And he's never had a drop of alcohol in his life. Not a drop. It's just, you don't do that. And so I was never exposed to it. I came over to America when I was 18, and I was just meant to be here for, or not here, in America, for a month to visit. I wanted to visit my mom's side of the family and get to know my grandpa and my cousins and my aunts and uncles. And so I went to this town in North Dakota, and it was summer. That's why I thought it was fun. And I got married. Oh, wait. I did. I was there. I was only supposed to be there for a month, but I met a boy, a farm boy. And within a month, we were engaged. And a couple months later, we were married. Okay. That's how I know. It was September of that year. He was raised religious as well, you know, a good Baptist farm boy, you know, and he didn't drink, and so we never drank. Was nothing. I never had it in my home. Didn't know anything about it. So when I say I was a late bloomer, I was a real late bloomer. But don't turn me off, okay? You those that started drinking early. I am a real alcoholic. I could have had it. All right, so I was 28 years old when I had my first drop of alcohol. And here's the thing. In a week, I'll be 61. 28 was a whole long time ago. A long time ago. And yet I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember I had a guest in my home, and they had what I now know to be vodka. And they said, would you like a drink? Now, it wasn't that it was like, oh, you're not allowed to drink, you know. It was, we just didn't drink. It was, you know, frowned upon. But man, I was like I said, I could have used a drink 20 years earlier. I was wild. I was like, yes, I would like one. Thank you very much. So this person put this vodka in some orange juice and gave it to me. And like I said, it was a long time ago, but I remember exactly where I was sitting. I remember exactly what I said, and I remember exactly what it was like. I took the swig of alcohol, and the first thing out of my mouth was, this is disgusting. Why would anyone drink this? Now I know why we don't drink. We've just ruined a perfectly good glass of orange juice. That was what I was saying. But what was baffling to me, and what is baffling to me, was in between each of those sentences, I was taking another swig. That's baffling. That is the only time I can remember ever consuming something that was disgusting and continuing to consume it. Now, later on, I was to develop a taste for it, vodka, you know, that's my thing. But at the time, I've not done that with anything else. Let me, you know, for example, I've had Brussels sprouts one time in my life. In fact, I've had one bite of Brussels sprouts to know I never need to have Brussels sprouts again. Why would anyone eat Brussels sprouts? You just ruin a perfectly good meal, you know? How baffling. But here's the thing. I'm different from all of my siblings. And from the moment, you all know what's coming. From the moment I took that drink, it had a profound effect on me, and I was able to have what we all call that great exhale. And all the noise quieted down. All the voices went away. And I was good. I was good. I like to say that it was like the genie came out of the bottle. It was magic. Little did I know that I was to climb into that bottle and from 28 to 44 years of age live in the circumference of that bottle. rather than it being magical and oh my gosh, the illusion of magic and freedom, and it's so seductive. And I followed it and I chased it and I was off to the races. Nothing stood. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been missing. Why in the world didn't I do this 20 years ago? And I was off to the races. Within a year, not even a year, within a year, I walked out of that marriage for no reason, other than I intuitively knew that I was not going to be able to drink the way I needed to drink, wanted to drink. I would never say I needed to drink. I don't have a problem. But how I wanted to drink. Why wouldn't you want to drink? And you're a wet blanket. You got to go. But I didn't know. I didn't know. And I remember my husband number one. You got to keep up tonight. Number one. I remember him standing in front of me and a tear running down his, because I just like, I'm done, I'm leaving, bye. No explanation. He didn't know anything until I eventually made amends to him. Years, decades later. His world just shattered. Here's this perfectly normal person, one month, 6 months later, completely different person. And he asked, a tear rolling down his eyes, and he asked me a very difficult question. Why? And I had no answer. I had no answer. But I was in the grips of alcohol, and I had no idea that it was already dictating everything about my life. And it said I had to go. Because that first bottle, that company left and left the bottle. That bottle quickly disappeared to be replaced by another, another, another. My drinking was secret immediately because we don't drink. And pretty soon I could not maintain that. And so it's his fault. I was trapped. 18, married, are you kidding me? I'm out on a farm. I went from a city of 3.5 million to living literally on a in a little house on the prairie. Not even near a town. And I'm 18 and I didn't know, and I had all this just all this stuff. And so I left. I walked out on him. I was excommunicated from the church because I did that. And if you don't know what that means, it means everybody sits around sort of like now and they talk about all the things I'm doing and they vote. All those in favor of kicking her out of the club, raise your hand. And I was kicked out. So I was excommunicated. I lost my friends, my family, my faith, my community. My family. Then I lost my value, my self-worth, my dignity, my morals. Small price to pay. I could drink the way I wanted. So, husband number two, hostage number two, came along and they sort of overlapped. I was still technically married, but, I was a limo driver. He was a client, it just happened. Anyway, so we had a lot of fun, and then he asked me to marry him, and I was like, okay, sure, that's great. Didn't know what else to do with myself. And then all of a sudden we got married, and he said, all right, we need to, because he was newly divorced, and I was almost divorced and all that. And so we'd go out, we'd go to the bars, we'd go dancing and all of that. We had so much fun. And then we got married 6 months later, and he's like, okay, now we gotta settle. We're adults, This is we gotta grow up. But by that time, I'm 30 or something, and we gotta be responsible. And I was like, wait a minute, that's not what I signed up for. And so again, I'm having to drink secretly and all of that. So I came up with a good plan. I didn't want to get divorced right away. I mean, a year is a little too soon. So I know I will go to law school. And that's noble. That's a good idea. I had really no interest or idea of being a lawyer, but it was 4 hours away, and I'd have to live there, and I wouldn't see him as much anymore. So that looked like that was going to work out. So, yeah, I don't remember much about my third year, my drinking was out of control. Before then, I was managing it. I thought I was managing it. I was managing it. But by the third year, I don't remember much about my third year, which should concern all of you that someone like me can actually pass law school, pass the bar, and practice law. There's something wrong with that system. I don't know. So then I graduated from law school, and things went from bad to worse, and we tried. No, he tried. I gotta not lie. He tried. And I was like, I know. We'll do a geographic. You and I will move. We'll move to Nebraska. And why Nebraska? I have no idea. It was in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska. I'm not talking the populated side of Nebraska. I'm talking the west side of Nebraska. There ain't nobody there. But there's this little town, and I was sure they needed a lawyer. And so we went there. I talked him into, he was such a successful businessman. I talked him into selling his business, the house, everything. And we moved down there. And so I hung up a shingle, and I'm practicing law. And he buys this little motel, and he's off. He hated every minute of it, poor guy. And I'm drinking myself to death every day. By this time, I am a daily drinker. He doesn't know what to do with me. I am not coming home at night. He doesn't know where I am. I'm doing things, and he's experiencing things that no human being should have to go through. I took that man, and he's a good, good man, to hell and back. And after one particularly really bad weekend, he said, I'm going to leave for the weekend, and when I come back, I want you gone. And what he didn't realize was I had been applying for jobs in South Dakota anyway, and I had heard back from them, and I got the job, and I was just fine, great. Because I always blamed him. Everything, everything was his problem. You know, you're such a nag. I mean, it's like when he'd say, you know, don't you think you've had enough? And I'd say, be quiet and eat your cereal. You know, it's just like, come on. It's nag, 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 nag. I'm like, you could use a drink, you know? Living with me was just it was just hell, and so he left for the weekend, and I called the movers, and the moving van showed up, and I said, all right, I want, you know, take that, and oh yeah, that was his custom Harley sitting there, I'll take that too, and I know, you know, I almost can say anything, and everybody's like, yeah, yeah, me. But I mentioned that, and the guys are like, oh, no. No, yeah. I'm still making amends for that one. I mean, how do you do that, collector's item Harley? It's just like, yeah, I'm still making. And then I forged the title, sold it, and bought myself a new Harley. It gets where I know. This is on the level of, you know, kicking a puppy or something. This is so bad. So bad. Anyway, I left. Good riddance. Left him holding the bag once again at this hotel. It took him about a year to sell that hotel. It took every cent. I landed him on the verge of bankruptcy. He moved back to North Dakota and lived in a friend's basement and started working and putting one foot in front of the... He's not one of us, by the way. He's a normie. And having to work and reestablish himself from the... I destroyed everything that I touch. When it says that we are like tornadoes tearing the way or through our lives or our loved ones' lives, it's not a joke. Collateral damage just strewn behind me. So at this point, the job I had applied for and got was I was legal counsel for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Apparently, we interview well, you know? But I'm coming near the end. I am going to wrap this, you know, get over this drinking part. But this is the last 5 years of my drinking, my 40s. And now I'm in a, talk about power, prestige, and possessions, okay? There are times where I am now the most important person in the room, not just in my mind, but actually am. I speak for the Chief Justice. I move in circles that are unbelievable to me. The things I've gotten to do and see and whatnot is amazing. But it ain't enough. And I am drinking. And also, other lawyers and politicians introduced me to something else called cocaine. And I'm walking in, and there's lawyers and politicians and whatnot, and that's what they're, and it's like, well, they're successful. It's not hurting them. And here's the thing. There's not a line I won't lightly step over if the illusion of happiness is on the other side. It's not that I have lower morals. It's I have none. If the illusion of happiness is there, I will lightly step over any line that I thought I would never cross. So now I have a huge love affair with cocaine. Really all that does is be able to make me drink longer and faster, okay? That's it. But I think I'm grateful in a way for that because it took me down faster. I don't know how many more years I'd been able to limp along, but it took me down every weekend. So I have such a prestigious job that I intuitively know I cannot drink publicly. I don't know why I know this, but I know that if I get into trouble, I'm fired. You cannot be in my position and do anything to embarrass the court. And so I have two friends left, drinking and drugging buddies, and I'll either be at their place or in my apartment. But on the weekends, to get what I need to get, the cocaine, is this is being recorded. I would go to the reservations and get this and bring it back for the week because I needed this to keep going and going and going. And it was supposed to last all week. But I'm just like, if I have it, I do it, and I do it, and I don't stop until, and then I have to, you know, wait until the weekend. But this is what I do. I leave to go to the reservations because I can drink the way I need to drink and want to drink. And I'm not going to be caught. I'm not going to be found out. And then I can get that other stuff, and I can bring it back. And that's how I'm living. So by day, I am an officer, super lawyer, officer of the court. And by night, I'm a criminal. And I'm living this double life. And I'm spiraling down. After a particularly bad weekend, Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, which was last weekend, there was a little hit and run action going on and a few other things. And, you know, I can't stick around if I run into something, you know. So I'm heading back, and I'm going through this. I gotta get out of here. I'm gonna go home early. So I'm heading back. I'm going through this city where one of my two friends that I have left lives, and he had disappeared like 2 months prior. Just fell off the face of the earth, ghosted me, and I didn't know what had happened. But I'm heading through. It's 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I'm still very intoxicated. I hadn't slept all night. Very intoxicated. I'm driving, which is why you tend to run into things. But I'm intoxicated, and I'm driving through them, and I'm needing a drink, although I wouldn't say that I needed a drink. I want a drink. And so I called him up, and I said, hey, I'm coming through your town. I haven't seen you for a while. Do you want to have a drink? I still cannot connect the dots. Most people on a Sunday morning, they'd say, hey, do you want to meet for coffee or perhaps breakfast? But I'm saying at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, hey, do you want to meet for a drink? And he said, sure. What I didn't know was where he had disappeared to 2 months prior was in with you guys. And that Sunday morning, he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. His phone was on vibrate, and it vibrated, and he looked down, and he saw my name. And he didn't know what I wanted, but he sure knew what I needed. And here's the thing, different from when I came into AA, he dove in, he got a sponsor, he worked the steps, and in 2 months, he was ready for my call. You guys, our new friends here that stood up during the countdown, I don't care, I think 14 days and a couple days and 30 days, you can save a life. My life was absolutely saved by someone that had 2 months sober. He was working the steps, and he was placed in a neutral and protected position where it had alcohol, where alcohol was in his relationship to alcohol. And with the knowledge of his sponsor, he said, I'm going to go meet her. So I was sitting there, and it was 2-for-1 Bloody Marys. That's not drinking, that's breakfast, okay? And I had 4 lined up, because you know the wait servers, they take so long. It's just, I had 4 lined up here. Those were for me. He was going to have to order for himself. And so I'm drinking, and he comes in, and I hadn't seen him for 2 months. And I could not even, I could hardly recognize his face. I could hardly recognize him. Because when he walked in, he was alive. Other than being an absolute raging alcoholic, he had another little problem called meth. And so he really looked very unhealthy last time I had seen him. But when he walked in, it was just like an absolute transformation, unbelievable transformation. He was healthy. He didn't look like the walking dead. His eyes were bright. There was someone at home. And the most, I mean, it was like this bright light just was shining on him as he's walking towards me. And the most thing that baffled me the most was this happiness just oozed off of him, just rolled off of him, and he slid into the booth, sat opposite me, and I'm just looking at him, and I don't know what's wrong, and I was like, hey, you can order, and he goes, no, I'm sober. And my response is, well, it sucks to be you. You know, and if I was a friend, this is how selfish and self-centered and self-absorbed I am. If I'm a real good friend, I'd be like, oh, that's really wonderful, because he really needed to get sober, you know. I mean, we drank together. He would nag me about my drinking. I'd nag him. You know, we'd say, you need to get sober. But I would say, good for you, and I don't need to drink. We can move these. You know, if I was a real good friend, if I cared anything about any of you, but I don't. And so I'm like, yeah, sucks to be you, and I kept drinking. Well, he proceeded to tell me what he had been doing for the last 2 months. I know it was like the perfect 12-step call, textbook, perfect. I don't remember a word he said, But I know it was perfect. He didn't lecture me about my drinking. He didn't even need to tell me about my, because we drank together. He didn't even need to tell me about his drinking. We drank together. All he told me was what he had been doing for the last 2 months. And he was just so alive and so enthusiastic. It was like, I love that part in the book where Ebby comes to visit Bill. And Bill opens the door. Bill's drinking. Just like me. I love the fact that he's like, more for me, you know. It's like, that's my guy, you know, just like me. But he opens the door and there's Ebby and he's bright-eyed and fresh and just like, his demeanor shouted good tidings. And so I don't, to this day, well, I'm intoxicated while he's talking to me, but to this day, I don't remember what he said, but I could not forget what he looked like. Again, our new friends, don't dismiss 1 or 2 months. You can carry the message just by how you look and how you act. In fact, that's the best big book that anyone's going to see from a distance. You can save a life. Even if you don't know how to carry the message, you can carry them to the message. Which is what he did with me that night. He didn't go with me. I had to keep driving. I got back in my car drinking, and driving, and I got back. And I was home a day early. And so there was no alcohol in the house. I wasn't expecting to be back on Sunday. I wasn't supposed to come back till Monday. I had the day off. And I know that I have all Monday. I'm not working. That's a lot of drinking time. And the liquor stores at Sunday night, they're going to close real soon. But he had given me a meeting list of that town. He came ready. And he had a meeting list. And I knew what time and I knew the address. I had it right there. And this battle started in me because I couldn't get him out of my mind and how happy he looked. And I just wanted that so bad. But liquor store. AA meeting, liquor store, AA meeting. To this day, I have no idea how, other than maybe some power that I despised. Remember, I've been kicked out of the club. And at that point, my heart and mind slammed shut against anything spiritual, anything. But anyway, I suspect it may have been that power that didn't reject me while I was rejecting it. Got me to a meeting. I drove to the meeting. I have no idea. And I walked in late, of course. I was intoxicated still. And they didn't say anything to me. They didn't embarrass me. I had a hoodie. The hood was up. I'm sitting. I was like that. I looked sick. I was not a vision for you. And I was hostile and I was angry, but I didn't know what AA was because I had gone from total non-drinking environment to immediately alcoholic drinking. And trust me, we don't talk, especially in my profession, you do not talk about detox. You do not talk about treatment. You don't talk about rehab. You don't talk about alcoholism. You don't talk about drug. I can get disbarred. You don't talk about that. So I honestly had never ever spoken to anyone, and I never knew anyone who had ever been to treatment before I came into AA. I sort of vaguely maybe had an idea of what you guys were, but I did not know anything. So I'm in there and I'm just like, okay, this is the happy club. Where's my happiness? You know, he got happy. He got happy. So I'm looking, this is why I'm coming. I want that happiness. I'm not an alcoholic. That's not why I'm here. And I'm really not interested in I just give me the happy stuff. Fix me. Please fix me. And then at the end, they started circling up to do this prayer. And I head for the door. Now, you guys have greeters in your meetings? Do you have greeters at the door and they greet you? I like greeters. I really like greeters, but I like blockers better. because the blocker saved my life is this guy. Oh, and by the way, this is why I need to say why I don't think I'm an alcoholic, okay? I cannot connect the dots. Because to me, for some reason, I don't know where I get this information, but it just floats around and I make it up and I take it in. But to me, an alcoholic is, first of all, you got a, it's a man. You're old and you live under a bridge and you drink something mysterious that's hidden in a paper bag. That's an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. Do you know who I am? Have you seen my business card? I'm not an alcoholic, right? But in that meeting, this is, there were six old men sitting around that circle. And I was like, I was right. I'm not an alcoholic. They're just a bunch of old men. Anyway, this old man, Gary, blocked the door with his body and stopped me from going out. And he stuck out his hand. He said, hi, my name's Gary. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know what it is. If someone sticks out their hand to you, it's just like an instinct or a reflex. You stick your hand out. So I stuck my hand out, and he shook it, and then he didn't let go. And he's got my hand, and then he takes the other hand, and he's got it, and he's like, come on, let me show you over to this table here. Do you have one of these big books? And I'm looking at him, I'm like, okay, I'm a lawyer, Gary, and that ain't no big book. medium at most, I don't know. I'm so arrogant that I came in for the first like 3 months. I was had my own private little campaign, and I would refer to this as the blue book in meetings. You know, in the blue book, blah, 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 blah. They were looking at me like I was crazy. And I was bound and determined to change this from the big book to the blue book. Because this is not a big book. I'm just saying. Anyway, so I didn't say all that out loud. I just said, no, Gary, I don't have one of your big books. And he gave it to me. My first big book was stolen from the club. And he said, take this and take it home and read the first 164 pages. And also, here's a token for you, a coin. And I looked at the coin, and it said 24 hours. And I remember thinking, should I tell him I'm not sober? As though he didn't know, right? I'm like, thanks for the coin. Thanks for the book. And I left. Never to go. I was like, I'm not going. But that coin bothered me. I was driving home, and it's in my pocket, and it's bothering me. And I was like, I know my alcoholic thinking, you know. I may not have potential, but I can figure things out. If I stay sober and earn that coin for 24 long hours, it will prove I don't have a problem. This is my solution. So I'm going to do it. I had the day off the next day, and so what I did is, all right, I'm going to earn that coin. And so I, not knowing how extremely dangerous detoxing is, because at that point in time, I was drinking on a daily basis about 4 bottles of wine or 1 large bottle of vodka a night. And I've been doing that for 5 years. There wasn't a day that I didn't have alcohol and often other substance in me. I didn't know. No one told me. So I started detoxing. Between the throwing up, the shakings, the seeing things, the hallucinations, the being so sick, I didn't know what was going on. I did read the 164 pages. And when I was finished, I slammed the book shut, I threw it across the room, it hit the wall, fell to the floor, and I said, that is the stupidest thing I've ever read in my entire life. What are they talking about? Ballet, you know, jaywalking. What is going on? I didn't identify at all. Well, you know, I'm detoxing. I'm sick. You know, I don't know how much I'm. But I mean, besides, it's very poorly written. They really need me to help edit this and rewrite it. I could be of use there. But it's stupid. And I don't even understand what in the world, why you I even need this book. But 8 o'clock that night, I got out and I went back to the group. And because I had earned my 24-hour coin, they never asked. I was very disappointed. And I would like to say that I jumped in, but I didn't, because I looked at these steps and I saw the G-O-D word everywhere. And I ain't having none of that. And I don't care that you say God as you understand him, or higher power. I know way more than you all, because I was raised by a father who had a doctorate in theology. And I was indoctrinated from, you know, I can out debate anyone on theology, and I have been, you know, not having it. So I'm just going to come to these meetings and try and get happy. And it took me about 2 weeks to identify as an alcoholic. I would not say that I was an alcoholic. It would come around, you know, hi, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic. It would come around to me, and I'd be just like, hi, I'm Judith. And I'd look at the person next to me like, what's your problem, you know? But after about two weeks of you guys explaining to me your relationship with alcohol, that it, you know, how you felt when you drank, more importantly, how you felt when you didn't drink, and how you, the physical effect, that how abnormal we are. When we start, we can't stop. And when we, every morning for the last 5 years, I was saying, when I would come to in the morning, I would say, not again, not again. I'm not doing that again. I'm a blackout drunk. I drive every night. I should be in prison. I never got caught. I should have hundreds of DUIs. I would have to go down to the garage, and where's my car? Is my car there? And I'd walk around my car hoping and praying there would be no dents on it. What did I do? Go through my phone, find out, are there any clues? Where was I? Who was I with? What happened again? Why am I like, why? Not again. Every morning, I swore to myself, I'm alone by that time. I have destroyed every relationship. I'm not with anyone. I am promising myself, never again, not tonight. I'm not going to do that tonight. But you guys explained about the obsession of the mind, and about 4 o'clock, this little thought would come floating in. It's Tequila Tuesday. And I'd be like, no, we said we weren't going to drink. I have all these reasons. I'm not going to drink. But I don't have a mental defense, and you explain that to me. And without any thought, that little insignificant, it's Tequila Tuesday, would push all those sound logical reasons out. And I'd be left with one thought. And then I would say, all right, I deserve it. I work hard. I'm pressure. I'll just have one. And I'd pop that cork, I'd have one, and I wouldn't care. And you know, once I had one, and by the end of the night, I'm passing out with 4 bottles gone again. That happened like Groundhog's Day, the same exact script, day after day after day, after month after month, after year, it didn't deviate one bit. The exact same script, the exact same scenario, the exact same life. And instead of the genie being out of the bottle, my world got smaller, 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 smaller. Until that was my very existence. I know how to quit. I just don't know how to stay quit. And you guys, after listening to you guys, then I'd be like, oh my God, I am an alcoholic. And that day I said the most beautiful, those were the most horrendous words that day, but today they're the most beautiful words I've ever said in my life. I'm Judith and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, but, oh, and I went too long at the beginning with Steve's dad's story. I'm not going to get to my story. Okay, fast forward. I'm really not happy. You would look at me in AA. I'm there every single day. I don't miss a meeting. I'm sitting in the middle of you, and you would have said, look at her go. Look at her. She has a commitment. She has a home group. It was a smoker meeting when I got sober. I'm a chain smoker back then. I would sit there. I would light one off the end of the other, and I have no solution, so I am smoking through the meeting. You can't see anything at the end of the meeting, you know. My job was to wash the ashtrays, and that was my commitment. I was there every day, and you would have said, look at her go. She's doing it. But I'm not doing it. I don't have a sponsor. I'm not doing the steps, and I am dying of untreated alcoholism in the middle of you. Going to meetings and not drinking kill people like me with no solution. I had physical sobriety, and for me, physical sobriety without recovery is hell. And I'm a ticking time bomb, and I'm getting sicker and sicker, and I'm like, where's this happiness for me? And at a, fast forward. Oh, so I wanted more power, more prestige. So I quit my job that I loved, and I went to work as an assistant U.S. attorney in the federal system, and that's a prosecutor for the federal government. You know, the FBI and all of that. Okay, so that was that. I didn't happen to read the job description very well, because my job description was to prosecute violent and drug crime on the reservation. I know. So the first case that I had to go to FBI school, and I told that story earlier during the whatever workshop, I think. Anyway, had fun and all that, but then I got back and I had my first case, and I knew him well. They were all excited. They thought they had the biggest drug dealer on the reservation. They didn't, but they thought they did. But anyway, so I had to disclose. I was like, the last thing I could do was be in court and have him see me. You know, I'm at the prosecution table. He's over on the, hey, you know. I can't sign anything. I can't let him know anything, right? And so I was like, you know, I can't really prosecute this case. I know him. And it was like bells and alarms. I mean, doors. It was crazy. And it's like, what is happening? And no one would speak to me for like a couple days a day. And then the U.S. attorney flew in on his jet, and they pulled me in. It was three FBI agents and the U.S. attorney and two assistant U.S. attorneys. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. And they grilled me for 3 hours. How do you know this person? Because they aren't stupid. You can't know somebody with that lifestyle. You don't casually know them. You know? And so how did you know him? And I'm like, and I know that my life is over. I know I'm going to federal prison. I know that they're going to go talk to him and offer him a deal, because even though he's a drug dealer, what they hate worse than him is people like me in the system doing what I was doing. And I know I'm heading to federal prison. I know my life is over. So Judas' program, by the way, of sobriety, physical sobriety, not recovery, is there's no honesty anywhere in that program. And I'm just like, no, you know, I just know him. And you know, and it's like that on TV, you know, one guy's offering you nice and offering coffee, the other guy's yelling and spitting in your face and blah. And I'm like, listen, you know, on the reservation, we're all related, you know. I'm not even Native, okay? I'm just saying anything, yeah. And they're not buying. They're like, you can leave. Don't leave town. We're gonna go talk to him. This isn't over. We'll be talking to you. So I packed my. I went in. I went out to my car, and I had a loaded pistol. And I'm like, this is at 11 and a half months, sitting with you guys. You know how people say my best thinking got me to AA? That's not my story at all. My best thinking gets me drunk, high, or dead. My thinking. I was sitting in the middle of you all dying of untreated alcoholism. After 11 and a half months, my best thinking was, fine, I'll go down to the reservation, I'll do what I need to do to get what I need to get, and then I will end it. That's my solution. And I'm sitting there with the gun, and I'm going to take my life because I know I'm going to prison. And then this thought came from outside of me. It was a thought. And the thought said, you know, there's really good, strong AA in that city over there. And I actually answered the thought out loud, and I'm like, fine, I'll go over there. But if that doesn't work, then I'm gonna go to the reservation, do what I need to do to get what I need to get, and I'm gonna end it. That's it. So I packed up and I headed out of town. Yes, I know the FBI said don't leave town, but they can find you. Don't worry, okay? They'll find you. So I hightailed it over to this other city, and I walked into this big book, Strong Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they saw that I was dying. It was where my friend lived, the friend that 12-stepped me. And I love to say that he still has 2 months more sobriety than I do. He got to celebrate. We celebrate 2 months apart, and he's still doing the deal too. And I walked into there, and they saw I was dying, and they just went to work. I like to say they were the ER of AA, and they just surrounded me. They appointed a sponsor to me. I talked about him a little bit at the workshop, and he kicked my butt through the steps. I met with him the first time for a number of hours. By the time I left his house, I was going to write my inventory, and within 5 days, I was to do my fifth step. And I've watched him work with guys now. I'm the only female he sponsors. He had to. He was told to. And I was like, you don't push your other, you don't do that with the others. And I said, why did you push me through so fast? And he said, because I didn't know if you were going to be alive from one day to the next, because I kept that loaded pistol. Because if this wasn't working, that's my only option. I cannot live sober without a solution. So I'm out of time, but I really want to tell you that I kicked my butt through the steps, okay? And I got results. I got results. Can I tell you one? Do you have, okay, all right. So one of the biggest things was I despised and loathed my father with white-hot rage. I hated him because, you know, like I said, he was a doctorate of theology. He's a big deal, published author, the whole bit, and over Australia. He's a big deal in certain circles. And so he stands up like this, you know, and talks to people, and everybody thinks he's, but in the home he's violent. And I hated him. I hated him. And he was on my fifth step. It was God, my father, and the staff member at boarding school that sexually molested me. Those were my top three. So my dad was way up there. My dad and God kind of got all meshed, which is why I have such a problem. So we worked through that, and I couldn't get it, and I'd go through the resentment, and I was like, okay, I got it, I know my mistakes, I got it. And then 2 days later, I'd come back to my sponsor, I don't got it, I hate him. We'd work through it again, tell me it again, I want to be free, tell me again. And we'd work at it, got it, no, I don't got it. I hated him, it consumed me. And finally, my sponsor said some stuff that just really hit home. He said, how about you turn your attention from what kind of father he is to what kind of daughter you are called to be today? Let's start focusing on what kind of daughter you are today. And that was the beginning of the healing. And then I had to make amends to him. And it's so interesting because I was making amends for the mistakes I was making. I had nothing to do with back then. What he did was wrong, illegal, violent. But I'm responsible as a 45-year-old. At this point, I'm 45. I'm responsible for who I am today. I gossip about him. I ridicule him to his face. I belittle him. I withhold love and affection. I withhold forgiveness. I demean him. I ridicule, I'm so disrespectful, I'm so demeaning. Those are my mistakes. So I went and I made amends to him. And you guys gave me such a great gift through these amends. Because if this is neutrality of emotion, I was down here with this loathing and the despising. But when I made amends, I went to neutral. And that was a gift. I was free. Just neutral. I was free. And I went along like that for year after year after year. And it was okay. I could be around him and I could respect him. And I was always on my best behavior. And I could be the daughter that I'm supposed to be. And I was neutral. And then in 2020, I got the phone call that he's been rushed to the hospital and he's dying. And I'm so glad that I did that I have you guys, that I did this work, because my side of the street was good. I was clean. And I went to them, we all converged from, Americans, Australians, we all converged on, the patriarch of the family, and we're all there. And I watched my siblings, and I watched my siblings go from pleading at the bedside, "Dad, do you love me? Dad, do you love me?" He could respond for the first day or two. "Dad, do you love me?" And then be out in the hallway cursing him, going back and forth, and I watched this. That would be me. Well, actually, I would have been drunk and not even shown up had it not been for you guys. And I remember, and I'm almost done, my mom wouldn't leave his side. And so the first night, I said, "Mom, you go, you get some sleep, everybody go. I'll sit with him at night. I'll volunteer to sit here. And so he's not alone." And I sat in this chair, hard chair, all night long. And I remember sitting there. And it occurred to me, this was the very first time I could ever remember being alone with my father when he wasn't hitting me. And through that night, I got to give him, they swab the mouth and give him water and ice chips and do his brow and call the nurses if he needed it. And I got to be of service to my father. And during that night, and it wasn't because he was dying, and it wasn't some grief that, manufactured emotion or anything like that, but in my service to him while he was there, for the very first time in my entire life, I went from neutral and I felt genuine love for my father that night. The first time. What a gift. I'm so grateful. The gift that you guys gave me. I would never have experienced that. Not only am I free, but I got to experience that. And so in that moment, I'm a little bit mischievous because I know he's going to die. And, he has a doctorate of theology. He's pretty in touch with stuff, right? So I was like, Dad, I wanted to know, what are you thinking about? Like, do you see a bright light or something, I said, Dad, what are you thinking about? And he raises his hand, and he pointed at me. Of all my siblings. Well, they're pleading, Dad, do you love me? And he pointed at me, and then he passed. I would have missed it all. Oh, real quick. I'm sorry. Okay, it's not my fault. It was Clarence and, the submarine, okay? All right, I completely forgot. I'm not in jail, okay? Don't you want to know that? Why? Okay. Okay. All right, so, but that was a gift. I had to share that, and thank you. Thank you for that gift, among so many more. And here comes the next one. So, I didn't go to jail. Yay. I got to see, his name was Dwight, the guy that was arrested. And I never heard, they never came and talked to me. They never came. And I was always like looking over my shoulder a little bit, for years. And then I was like, then I moved to North Dakota, and whew, maybe they can't find me up here, whatever. But then I went back to the reservation about 5 years, 5 years sober, for good reasons this time, good reasons. And I saw Dwight, and he was there. And I was like, oh, my gosh, and I wanted to make amends to him. And I went, and I was like, Dwight, I said, so, and he was sober. He was sober. He got sober in prison, and he actually went to prison for 5 years. And I said, I'm so sorry. You know, I couldn't help, and I didn't help. I'm so sorry. And I said, Dwight, I got to know, why didn't you tell them? Why didn't you tell them on me? You know you would have gotten a good deal. You know you would have gotten a good deal if you would have exchanged you for me. I said, why didn't you tell them? And he said, well, because you were always so nice to me. Okay, that sounds really nice. Oh, but that was like a knife in my heart. I wasn't nice to him. He had cocaine, okay? All right. So here in that moment, I'm like, oh my gosh, someone went to prison and I was set free. How do you right those scales? And so from that moment, I committed myself to a life of service, opening my home, taking in people, detoxing, carrying this message wherever I can, doing whatever. Because how do you ever right those scales? He went to prison and I went free, and I've been so blessed. I lost my profession and I lost all of that, right? So like I said, I lost all the power and the prestige and the possessions. I ended up with nothing. But 2 years ago, I got a call from the tribe. And they said, how would you like to come and be our chief judge? So now you're looking at the chief judge on the reservation, and I get to be of service on the reservation instead of harm, and I get to sentence people to AA. You can't make that up. So I'm here to say, it doesn't matter that I'm baffled. I'm still baffled. I don't know the answers to most anything. And it doesn't matter if you have potential or not. The directions are here, outlined, and all I need to do is follow this, and your life and my life gets transformed, and I want to thank you for my life. Thank you.